Let's have a phone. We have got two items for the committee. And we will first deal with the briefing by the IMF to the committee. I must say, this time around, the arrangements were far much better in terms of our interaction, because in the past, I think 2 years, committee members would be required to come back from constituency period to have an interaction with the IMF delegation, chapter 4 report. I think normally it would be around somewhere the 4th of December and all that. So I want to sincerely appreciate, because we did raise the challenges in relation to that time of the year, that this time we have found space within our normal schedule as parliamentarians. And we're looking forward to this briefing and interaction with yourself. It's not a number that will matter in terms of our committee members, but it's the input that will come. And having observed the current global situation and the impact it has had on South Africa, I'm sure also looking forward to hear our views about the challenges in terms of the world economy and how do you want to position ourselves as South Africa, or to continue to position ourselves as South Africa, to make sure that we contribute positively in trying to stabilize the global economy. But to also be very, very, very much interested in just getting from your side what are your observations and what you really think needs to happen. I was sent to this committee secretary that the delegation this time around is quite a sizable delegation that suggests to us that the issues are too weighty, unlike in the past. I would want to assume that the leader of the delegation is Mr. Kelvin McDonald in terms of the list I have here. If I'm wrong, I'll hand over to you and then you'll introduce yourselves and tell us who's the leader of the delegation and take it from there. Thank you very much. Over to you.
Okay, thank you very much for this opportunity for to brief you on how we see current developments in South Africa as well as in the global economy. I am the current mission chief for South Africa. I am an assistant director or division chief of the South Africa, so one of two Southern African divisions in the African Department of the IMF. I have some of my colleagues here with me. I would like to introduce themselves.
Thank you very much. My name is Jorge Canales Krilenko. I'm a senior economist working in South Africa in Washington, D.C.
Good morning. I'm Yibin Wu, a senior economist working on South Africa team. Thank you.
Senior economist.
Thank you. Estelle Shilio, desk economist on South Africa, based in Washington, D.C.
Roberto Pirelli, I am an economist with the IMF strategy and both department. I do the external sector.
Hi, I'm Denise Leder. I'm from the National Treasury and I'm traveling with the IMF team.
Okay, now if you, should I continue? Sure. Yeah. Well, as you know, we were here in May, June of this year, and we conducted the 2012 Article 4 consultation with South Africa, which is something that we do every single year, where we review current developments in the global economy, developments in South Africa, and we look at the prospects going forward. And this report was discussed by our executive board in August and is published on our website, and I'm sure you may have had a chance to look at it. The
government of South Africa held a press conference at the time it was published and also gave their views as to how they see the report. And we're very happy to say that in most cases, overwhelmingly, the IMF staff and management and board of the IMF and the authorities agreed on the major conclusions of that staff report. So what I would like to do this morning is just to highlight a few key issues from that Article 4 staff report, and then to very quickly turn to the more recent developments in the global economy since that time in August when the Article 4 consultation report was discussed by the Executive Board, and then finally say a few words about more recent developments in South Africa and the policy challenges as we see them going forward. I should point out at the outset that this is our first day of discussions since arriving in Cape Town yesterday. We will be going on to Pretoria tomorrow to continue our discussions with the National Treasury and the South African Reserve Bank. So we're just beginning this visit, and we have a lot to discuss with the government officials over the next week or so. Now, the 2012 Article 4 consultation highlighted a number of points, and here I would just maybe mention, you know, maybe 6 or 7 points that came out from that report that I think were very important to highlight. First, what was the context in which this Article 4 consultation took place? The main context, of course, back in at the beginning of June, was that we were looking at a global slowdown in the economy, in the world economy, which in our view delayed the South Africa's recovery, which had started on the back of the worst days of the global economic crisis back in 2008-09-10. So the global environment was still not very kind to South Africa. And I will say a little bit more about current development, as I promised earlier, in a short while. Now, this, of course, increased the risks for South Africa. But our main conclusion at the time was that vulnerabilities in the South African economy remain relatively low, largely because the external debt of South Africa is moderate, and about half of it is rand-denominated, and that reduces the exposure of South Africa to the changes in global risk sentiment. In addition, South Africa has a very flexible exchange rate, which provides a natural buffer against external risk, and we were very happy at the time to report that the banking and financial sector of South Africa was very resilient to the global economic crisis and was adequately capitalized and had sufficient cushions to ward against further external shocks. Second point I would highlight is that we concluded at the time that fiscal and monetary policies that the government of South Africa pursued on the back of the global economic crisis was appropriate to the slowdown. These policies provide adequate stimulus in the face of weak external demand and what we call a negative output gap, meaning South Africa's output being below its potential. And we also advise that if things were to get worse in the global economy, that monetary policy should play a more active role in continuing to combat the downturn in the global economy, given that the authorities had used up a lot of their fiscal room in the earlier phase of the crisis. The fiscal stance that was announced at the time early this year in the budget we felt was appropriate, and we felt it would emphasize the importance of rebuilding buffers and the need to rebalance spending away from a growing wage bill, which we saw in the early days of the crisis in 2008, 2009, and 2010, and toward a greater emphasis on capital and infrastructure spending. Now, we discussed with the authorities during that Article 4 consultation some of the key medium-term policy challenges facing South Africa,
And we agreed at the time with the National Treasury and the South African Reserve Bank and other stakeholders in the government that going forward, labor and product market reforms would be key to reduce high structural unemployment in South Africa. I mean, I don't think I need to say to you that South Africa, even before the crisis, had relatively high unemployment rates of about 20% or so. And this increased during the period of the crisis and still remains relatively high at over 25%. So we felt that over the medium term, there needed to be greater emphasis on reducing what we call the structural unemployment that existed even before the onset of the crisis. We emphasized the need to address the very high margins that many firms make in product markets and the high wage settlements in the larger economy, which we felt had resulted in uncompetitive domestic cost of production and was threatening South Africa's external competitiveness. We believed at the time and continue to do so that the high wages for some sectors of the economy contributed to some of this structural unemployment and it prevented especially new entrants to the labor market from gaining active employment. Staff and the authorities therefore agreed on the need to improve the competitiveness of South African economy over the medium term, to reduce unemployment, to strive for more flexibility in the wage setting process, more flexible labor and product markets regulations, to improve the business environment, and where needed active labor market policies to create employment opportunities, especially for the young. We also discussed during that Article 4 consultation the need to have improved service delivery in health. We discussed at great length the government's plans for healthcare reform, which we think was desirable, and also social security reform. And finally, we agreed on the need to stress greater investments in infrastructure to remove bottlenecks and to support growth. So these were sort of the main points that came out of that Article 4 consultation that we had back in June and eventually discussed at our executive board in August. Now, what has happened since then over the last few months? Well, unfortunately, the global environment continues to be rather unkind to South Africa. We have seen a further deterioration in the global economic environment. Our own October World Economic Outlook produced by the IMF revised down world economic growth from 3.5% that was announced back in July to 3.3% for 2012. And for 2013, the expected growth was revised down from 3.9% to 3.6% compared to what was projected earlier in July. Conditions in the euro area deteriorated further during the summer, and there were renewed concerns about the viability of the euro area. And outflows from many so-called peripheral countries in the eurozone to the core countries of the zone tended to increase sovereign spreads on bonds in many of these countries. And growth in the euro area was actually revised down by the IMF from an already low rate to barely growth for 2012 and 2013. But to the credit of the Europeans, the IMF also felt that the policy response in some areas were relatively positive. For example, the Eurozone announced a 100 billion euro program with Spain to restructure banks. And there has been ongoing work on a banking union and a single supervisory authority in the Eurozone area. And also the European Central Bank announced its plan to have outright purchases of bonds under the so-called European Stability Mechanism. In other parts of the world, in the United States, for example, whereas the second quarter growth was disappointing, the third quarter growth was somewhat better, and there are some signs of housing market stabilization. But of course, there are very significant risks in the U.S., as you all, I'm sure, are aware of, and you heard a lot of that last night during the elections commentary, a lot of discussion about avoiding major contractions in fiscal policy in the U.S. By coming at the end of this year or early next year, unless there can be a sort of an agreement between the different branches of government on how to improve the fiscal position in the U.S. economy. So there are risks, major risks emanating from the U.S. At present. And in other parts of the world, in the emerging markets, there have been some policy tightening in China, in Brazil, in Turkey. Weak global demand has also affected growth in other parts of the world, such as China and in India. And so the global environment across the board has not been as favorable as one would like for South Africa. Now, added to that, we have also had some development in South Africa itself, which I'm sure you all have on your minds. So the result of this is that the deterioration in the global economy, as well as the internal domestic strikes that you've had in the mining sector and other sectors of the economy, has without doubt had some impact on growth going forward in the South African economy. And this was acknowledged in the Minister of Finance's recent presentation of the medium-term budget policy statement. As well as we have seen some downgrades by Standard & Poor's and Moody's, which has taken its toll on South Africa's international reputation and has had some weakening effect on the rand, primarily because of a worsening growth outlook and some loss of confidence in terms of the ability to maintain the kind of fiscal policies that are needed over the medium term for economic stability. The result is that the medium-term budget policy statement announced by the government, of course, expects lower revenues to the budget and somewhat higher fiscal deficits over the medium term. The government, however, restated its commitment to try to reduce public debt over the medium term, as was originally intended in the original budget that was announced this year. From our point of view, we think that these two major developments in the South African economy, that is the impact of the strikes, the somewhat weaker fiscal position, as well as the continuing difficult situation in the global environment, strengthens the case for the policy advice that we offered in the 2012 Article 4 consultation report. And as I outlined earlier, the main thrust of this policy advice was, one, to maintain investor confidence in the South African economy through continued fiscal consolidation, to contain growth in public sector wage bills, to create space for infrastructure spending, and to rely increasingly on monetary policy to support economic recovery if conditions in global environment continues to deteriorate further, and to continue the push for reforms in product and labor markets over the medium term. So in conclusion then, let me just say that South Africa clearly continues to be adversely affected by the global economy, and added to that, it faces some internal domestic shocks. These two developments have certainly weakened the fiscal outlook and created a greater urgency for action on the part of the government to restore and maintain investor confidence in the economy. As I mentioned at the outset, this is our first day of business in South Africa, and we will be discussing all of these issues with the National Treasury over the next week and with the South African Reserve Bank, as well as the discussions that we are having with you now will also provide us with more information about how you see developments and profits in the South African economy. And we will, of course, be meeting with other stakeholders such as banks, private sector people in the South African economy in order to update our assessment of developments and prospects going forward. So let me stop here, and I look forward to hearing your views on these issues that I raised, both in terms of the global environment as well as developments and prospects in the South African economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Honorable members, I just find your summary very, very, very incisive and informative on my part. But I leave the rest to committee members to engage with the presentation, both in the form of questions and comments, because it's an interactive session. It's not a question and answer session. Honorable Luyenge, followed by Honorable Kuranoff, Honorable Harris, and Honorable Desmond Ryan, in that order.
Thank you,
Honorable Ross.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also welcome the report that has been given to us, the summary, which is actually full of everything. It's not a skeleton that one would say we will put flesh, so we will eat on what you have given us. My clarity on my side is the thing that I would want to get in accordance with the view of the IFF in relation to the impact of a global economic downturn in South Africa. In the beginning, in the initial stages of the economic downturn previously, we were seen or told that the recession of that period did not affect much South Africa as a country and a member of the global community. What is the view that you have pertaining to that as against the status quo? Are we better than before? Or are there any suggestions that you may come up with in relation to the future of our economy? And also, would you then suggest that as a response not to postpone infrastructural development in the country as a form of an investment, don't you think we need to take the route of maybe borrowing so that we are not experiencing much more backlog in terms of our economy, and then maybe in the very near future things will come right and we'll be having such a backlog if we said, okay, let us maybe suspend certain aspects of development, like especially in the infrastructure sector in Gwasila.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm sorry, I was trying to keep up a quorum with the Rules Committee, and the Speaker is in the chair there, so it was difficult to get out of that committee. But thank you for allowing me in here. Just two questions. The first one is, we have seen two downgrades by credit rating agencies in the last month. One has opted to wait. Now, I would like to know, in terms of the assessment of the IMF, whether they
And, you know, if we look and see the reasons they've given for the downgrade, whether it should not have been wise for the other two also to delay their judgments. And then secondly, with the election of Barack Obama in the second term, and we will see a regime change in China, do you think that will have a positive effect maybe on world economic recovery? Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. I only have questions. I think broadly my questions are around the same theme you will see, and that is that there's very, very little divergence between what you are saying at the IMF and what the National Treasury is saying. I don't think, in fact, probably there's not very much difference with what the opposition is saying, and I represent the official opposition. But clearly there is, unfortunately, an ideological constraint to implementation. That's certainly my analysis. So you talk about active labour market policies that could help in the short term, and then labour and product market reforms. Those are things that the finance minister talks about too. Would you agree with me that there is some other constraint that prevents these things from happening despite good intentions of the National Treasury? And what is your advice? I mean, how do other emerging markets deal with these kinds of political constraints to the implementation of policies that are generally accepted as being the right approach? You talk about the shifting of the infrastructure towards infrastructure, but it's away from the public sector wage bill. That's fine, but that speaks to another constraint in this economy that the finance minister himself indicated in February, and that is that the state-owned entities in 2010 only managed to spend 60% of their infrastructure budgets. So I would argue, and I would be interested if you agree, whether that is a significant additional constraint, which is about capacity of implementation, and how do you set about improving that capacity. Obviously, the reforms, the policy reforms relating to the labour market are by far the most important, but you also talk about reforms to promote inclusive growth and social cohesion. I mean, in general, I see South Africa's growth is very disappointing when you look at other emerging markets, even on the rest of the continent. I personally link that to, as you point out, our major trading partner is Europe, and we have been significantly affected by their slow growth. But I'm interested in why we are dragged down by European slow growth rather than buoyed by African growth, which is relatively strong compared to the rest of the world. And to me, that the best number that I've seen that explains that is the fact that we're only the 10th largest exporter to the rest of the continent. I mean, countries like the Netherlands and Spain export more to Africa than we do, as Africa's largest economy and part of this continent. To me, that explains the our relatively poor growth performance. I'm interested if you agree with me, and then what South Africa can do to try and boost trade with the rest of the continent and get competitive, move up from 10th. I'll leave that.
Honorable Gordon Offers, taking my first question, it was on the downgrading. My second and my last question, Chair, is, maybe let me start with a comment. I think over biasness to provision of social security system might in the main have a very negative contribution towards the expectation and perception of the community. As it's currently then, when every time when government tries to reduce their contribution on social security system, there is a strong resistance, a hence strong resistance on the austerity measures that are currently being introduced in Europe specifically. I just want to check from the IMF, are there any lessons to be learned from these developments that are happening in Europe in as far as various governments or maybe various economic contributions to social security system is concerned? Is there anything that we need to learn from these experiences? Because with seamlessness, people don't understand easily the essence of the introduction of these austerity measures. Thanks.
No. I've got Honorable David Ross. You have had your turn. You spend a lot of time talking about that, your little posturing.
I hope I'm not seeing Tim's question there later. Chair, thank you very much. We've seen in the August report that there was growth in a recession environment in South Africa, which was positive and had our fiscal credibility to a certain extent of the country, that we were not in danger in terms of the debt to GDP. But that could change significantly if we start embarking on an infrastructure build program. The debt to GDP, of course, we will have to invest, and hopefully we will invest into productive investment and move away from the spending on the wage bill to a certain extent, and that we will have some moderation in terms of the social grants. And those are the two issues that perhaps I would urge the committee to take forward, these spending on wage bill and investments in terms of the social grants, and to see how we can balance that very delicate act in future. But Chair, my question is with regard to the monetary policy to play a more active role, and this brings me to the proposed Credit Act, where we've seen, like in South Africa, development of unsecured lending to borrowers, and with the Banking Association of South Africa has also made some significant submissions now, and I think we will start working on the Credit Act next year, hopefully. But my question is, are we a little bit late on this, and could we have done more in terms of the time frame to see that consumers in South Africa don't go into a spiral debt in terms of how much they owe? And I think the banks are responsible for 91% of unsecured lending to South African consumers. But Tim has mentioned the infrastructure spending. Okay. I'd just like to add my concern on that, on the 60% of the budget that was not spent in terms of this. This is the vehicle that will take South Africa out of our problems in terms of infrastructure spending, but we have seen very little buy-in from the private sector, to my mind. We've seen Marion Roberts indicated that since the World Soccer Tournament, the World Cup Soccer Tournament, there were no tenders issued to one of the biggest construction companies in South Africa. And the proposed targets of 4 trillion rand to be spent within 15 years and 844 billion within the next 3 years. The buy-in of the private sector, if that is something you can take forward perhaps in your discussion, that would be very important. And also the funding, how will it be funded? And that brings me to the concern of state-owned entities, the state of readiness of state-owned entities in terms of their fiscal space to embark on the infrastructure spending. That would be important questions. The committee has spoken about a weak global demand, and domestically we've seen the same thing, but also in terms of electricity supply in South Africa, which is usually problematic at this point in time in terms of our reserve margins, but also in terms of the pricing of electricity. Now, I believe that we should encourage more electricity to be sold and not encourage our current electricity provider, Eskom, advocates that we should use less electricity. I'm not talking about the concept of saving electricity, I'm talking about the concept of selling more electricity to enhance economic growth to see that we improve our investments in the economy. Because we have constraints in that regard, and we have cutting constraints where country consumers are paying to a certain extent in terms of the Eskom cutting formula of cost, that they are paying for the new build programs, and that reflects in the cost of replacement assets. And it's also a return for the investor, two state-owned entities, which is the government of 8.16%. It's, to my mind, a certain double taxing on investors in South Africa. And I think those issues would be important. And what is your views in terms of the global picture, sir, with regards to administrative prices? Should we not move towards a more inflation-related target in terms of administrative prices when you have year-on-year increases in electricity? And you have Eskom, our electricity provider, telling the public of South Africa that in the next 15 years, we will only get to inflation-related prices. We accept that they work on the model of cost-reflective prices, but we think the model is highly inflated, and the formula of Eskom needs to be questioned. And I believe those are issues that you can discuss, perhaps with the Reserve Bank, where we had huge support in terms of the Reserve Bank governor advocating inflation-related tariffs. Chairperson, and then just my last comment and question. We welcome the gradual liberalization of exchange controls, but what would be the appropriate time frame for the full liberalization, in your views? Thank you very much for the opportunity.
over to you.
Thanks a lot for those comments and questions. I'll try to respond to as many of them as possible, and also I will give the floor to any of my colleagues who would like to jump in and add any further clarification or to cover any points that I missed. As you say, we're trying to make this as interactive as possible. A number of the comments and questions sort of overlap, so I will not sort of respond specifically to each person all the time. I think, for example, the first set of questions having to do with the global environment and a number of the other comments are all related in terms of the impact that the global environment has had on South Africa and what the appropriate response should be in the South African economy, both in the short term as well as over the medium term. I think in the first question was raised as to whether or not we are surprised at the impact that South Africa, the impact that the global environment has had on South Africa. I think for the very early days of the global slowdown, it was clear that South Africa was going to be impacted in terms of lower growth, lower exports. South Africa exports a lot to the European Union, and we have seen it even in recent times, its trade deficit continues to increase. Because of the soft demand for many South African exports to the Eurozone area in particular. So there is obviously a trade channel effect affecting the exports and growth prospects of the South African economy. We did discuss during the Article 4 consultation a number of issues related to the diversification of South Africa's trade relations, and a number of comments touched on that. And in fact, the National Treasury, as well as other government officials that we talked to, all made the point that South Africa needs to export more to the rest of sub-Saharan Africa and to rely less on Europe as a destination. And we highlighted that point in the Article 4 consultation report. We think that we support that attempt at diversifying trade relations in sub-Saharan Africa. We know that the government is intent on strengthening trade relations in the SADC region, as well as more broadly sort of a tripartite growth in trade integration covering not only SADC, but also the East African community, as well as COMESA. And we think that this further trade integration in Sub-Saharan Africa would lead to a much more diverse trading relation between South Africa and the rest of the world. It's also good for the rest of Africa also in terms of increasing their opportunities to export to South Africa. And we think that further trade integration will generally be positive for the continent. And already we've seen South African exports growing quite significantly to the rest of Africa. So this is a trend that is already taking place. But clearly, there can be more concerted action in this area, and this has already happened, we know, in terms of developing one-stop trading ports. We know in Mozambique you have that to facilitate easier cross-border trade, and I think it's a question of replicating this in the rest of the region. So this is sort of one thing that South Africa can do to improve its growth prospects. Of course, you know, there are things that need to be done domestically in South Africa as well, and we talked a lot about this in the Article 4 consultation report also, and we will continue to discuss these issues with the authorities. And these relate to improving the competitiveness of the South African economy vis-a-vis the rest of the world. And this is where the infrastructure investments come in. We think many of the infrastructure investments can improve the domestic external competitiveness of domestic firms. Of course, we're also concerned, like you are, that implementation capacity is a constraint on many of these infrastructure projects. And we certainly believe that there should be greater efforts made to involve the private sector, if that's feasible, to improve on the delivery of infrastructure services, and to improve on that implementation rate that you say is about 60%, which is quite low. So there are obvious bottlenecks in a number of areas, and these need to be addressed over the medium term to further enhance the external competitiveness of South African firms and to improve its growth prospects over the future. A comment was also made on the how others view South Africa and the rating agencies in particular, and the question was whether we would agree that it would have been better for the rating agencies to wait before issuing their downgrades. Well, you know, we don't really have an opinion on what rating agencies do per se, and we're not really in the business of second guessing their decision to issue a downgrade or not to issue a downgrade. I mean, we have to somewhat respect their own judgment. I mean, this is part of the sort of global architecture in which we work. Rating agencies look at the economy just as we do. They listen to what we say. They listen to what others say. They make their own judgments. Sometimes they're right. Sometimes they're not. We have said what we think the prospects of the South African economy are in the Article 4 consultation report. They make their own judgment, and they decided that a downgrade was necessary given their own sort of lack of confidence in the ability of the government to deliver on its fiscal outcomes. We continue to support the government in its attempt to deliver those outcomes, and of course we believe that the government has the fiscal and monetary institutions to deliver on them, and our job as IMF is to help support that process. But if the rating agencies think otherwise, then we cannot, of course, change that. But one can only hope that if the government does improve on its credibility on the fiscal front, the rating agencies will change their opinion of the South African economy. Now, whether or not the elections in the U.S. or the change in leadership in China will change the global environment and improve global prospects, one can only hope that this will be so. And I think there are a lot of people who are very hopeful that following the U.S. elections, that there will be a renewed effort on the part of President Obama, who has been reelected, to work with the new Congress to try and agree on fiscal policies going forward. As we all know, the looming fiscal cliff, as it's called, which would lead to automatic cuts in expenditures and increases in tax rates, could be quite significant in terms of contraction of government, of the fiscal position in the U.S., and that sudden contraction can obviously spill over to the rest of the global economy and lead to a greater slowdown in world growth. So, I think our managing director of the IMF has been saying over the weekend in Mexico at the G20 meeting that this is one of the most important challenges that the global economy faces now. And so we're all very hopeful that we will not go over that fiscal cliff in the U.S., but we have to wait and see what happens. And if we have a good outcome there, then that would certainly be reassuring for the global economic community. So one has to wait to see how that plays out. Now, there was also a number of questions about how do you overcome the political constraints to very difficult structural reforms. We appreciate this point very much, and I think that these are difficult reforms when we talk about reforming markets or labor markets, because there are always going to be winners and losers in any kind of structural reform of this type. I think the big question is whether it can be done in such a way that the overall welfare of the economy goes up, even if there are some losers along the way, and what can be done to ameliorate the conditions of those who don't get everything that they want in these reforms. So the challenge is to do that in a way that is politically feasible. Now, I know this is easier said than done. And you asked whether there were other cases that have carried out these very difficult reforms successfully. I could not think of any offhand, but if there are any of my colleagues who have any suggestions, I will certainly ask them to mention them as soon as I finish speaking. but I cannot sort of give you a very good example just off the top of my head. But clearly, this is a challenge that South Africa faces and one that has to be addressed over the medium term, because we're dealing with you know, very, very high structural unemployment. I think my colleague from, I think, Roberto, who's Brazilian, he may have some examples of how Brazil tackles very, very high levels of structural unemployment. I might not put you on the spot. but I think the Brazilian case is probably the one that comes closest to my mind in terms of what you can do to bring that kind of high level of unemployment down. I'll probably ask him to talk a little bit about that in just a few minutes. Now, in terms of lessons on social security reforms, and of course, this is also a very difficult area. It's a difficult area even for, that's one of the challenges that are faced in the U.S. as well right now, how to improve on the solvency of social security benefits. And here again, you know, there are a number of ways in which governments have attempted to deal with this problem. This I have a little bit more concrete experience with. There are obviously issues to do with the contribution rate that you can address in terms of sharing the burden between them, between the employer, the government, if you're talking about the government social security system or any other private insurance, and the employee. You can also look at the way to deal with issues such as the retirement age to make it a bit more affordable. There's also the benefit formula that one can look at. But there are no easy fixes again, and the question is to transition these changes in such a way that you minimize the impact on those who are going to retire or benefit from the system in a short while, so that you sort of spread out the effect of these changes over a period of time. And this has been done. Of course, we saw in the case of France recently with the previous President Sarkozy, this was a very contentious issue because they wanted to raise the retirement age very quickly. But other countries have done it and done it in a way that it has been sort of phased in over a period of time with less difficulty. So there are lessons there, and we certainly in the IMF have looked at this, and we're willing to share these sort of cross-country experiences on how others have dealt with these kinds of reforms with you as needed. Whether we need higher inflation targets, we have argued in the Article 4 consultation report that one of the benefits of the inflation targeting regime as carried out by the South African Reserve Bank is that it has really served them well. It has sort of improved on the credibility of monetary policies. We think that we don't see a particular need at this time to raise the targeted inflation zone or range. They have a very flexible inflation targeting range. They don't have a particular point. They have a band in which they operate, and this has served them very well. So we think they have sufficient flexibility to operate within that band, and therefore we have not been recommending any major changes in that area. Full liberalization of exchange controls. Again, we discussed this in Article 4. We did not at the time advocate any acceleration in these reforms, in these liberalization reforms. The government has been doing it at their own pace, which we have supported, and we think that this has been to the benefit of South Africa, and we don't see any particular urgency to move faster at this particular point in time. So let me just turn over to Roberto or any other of my colleagues who may want to say some additional few words.
I will briefly talk about the Brazilian experience. I think over the last 15 years, the country has gone through a very deep transformation an economy with very high structural unemployment, very high inflation, very low investment, to an economy that has a very low-behaved inflation, around 5%, record low unemployment rates, around 5% as well, record low level of underground jobs, so most of the labor force now is formalized, and a profound shift on the exports portfolio. So I think if I could summarize in a tripod, I would say that Brazil combined three main things. One was a very credible fiscal / monetary policy framework, where they had the fiscal discipline to not allow the debt to go too high. In effect, it actually came down significantly. The second was a special budget for capital projects, and this has helped the country a lot to avoid supply bottlenecks. So the country has some fiscal targets, but with some special budgets for capital projects. And this includes also some public-private partnerships that could be further exploited here. And third, and perhaps most interesting, there was a set of policies directed to the very poor, very marginalized citizens. Over the last 10 years, Brazil was able to remove from the below poverty line zone about 40 million people. This was done with a combination of many things: conditional cash transfers, especially for the children, so that you could reduce the infant labor and allow them to study, to go to school. The second was a set of programs of requalification, retraining. So there was indeed a concern with the so-called lost generation. In the 21st century, there was a huge number of people who didn't have the skills to be integrated in the economy, and they were subject to government projects that requalified them. And for those who were unemployed already, gave them the opportunity to leave the unemployment zone as quickly as possible. And third, there was some attempts to diversify the external trade. So until the mid-2000s, the U.S. and Europe were the main trade partners of Brazil. Now China is. So the country has to go through a series of reforms that involve both the public and private sectors, but with an eye on regaining competitiveness, especially on the export sector. The situation nowadays is slightly, I'd say, better than 2 years ago, but the global crisis continues to make an effect. And I think that's the same situation here. But I think that's pretty much what I could say for now, and we can perhaps in another opportunity to go in more details on each of these things.
Thanks, Roberto. Jorge?
Yeah.
I think I just want to touch on one of the questions that was raised regarding the investment in infrastructure. Part of that is made by public enterprises. That was the issue of the pricing. Our view is that the pricing should reflect cost recovery, and that also you have to be careful in that the generation of that services, which include energy and electricity, like they have to be done efficiently so that efficiencies are not passed on to the consumer. And there are several methods that can be used, and they need to be explored to see which is the one that best fits the case of South Africa. But we understand that there's been significant increases in electricity, for example. We understand that they were starting from a very low base, didn't allow for the investment needed to be made in the creating bottlenecks, so that's not a good situation either. So our position on that could emphasize that the pricing should reflect the cost of the generation that includes investment in the needed infrastructure for that, but also that one has to be very careful in guaranteeing the efficiency of the generation of those services so that undue costs or inefficiencies are not passed on to the consumer. There was also a question about our view of the framework for granting credit in general, and there was an exercise done by the IMF and the World Bank a few years back, and there was a follow-up in 2010. The view is fairly favorable. There were some
areas for growth that were identified, and there have been significant advances in those areas over the last few years. And we understand that the growth in unsecured lending, although high, is from a very low base, so still not systemic, and we understand that there are measures that are being taken to address the potential risks. So to summarize our view of the framework, supervisory and regulatory framework in South Africa is fairly positive, and that there's been significant advances that have been taken over the last few years and are being taken to improve every time. But one needs to be constantly, as the institutions of the country are, monitoring potential risks and address them in time.
There's no fucking baby. Okay. Any other comments? Can you have your hand up?
I'm interested in a quick follow-up on the second intervention that was described from the Brazilian experience, which is, I think it was described as special budgets for capital budgets. I'm assuming that you have a full understanding of our fiscal system. How would such an approach be reflected in our current fiscus? First time I've heard of what's called special budget. I'd like to understand how South Africa could look at emulating such an approach if it would fit within our current fiscal system. And then a question that I forgot to ask earlier was, you know, we have this medium-term expenditure framework, so we project our budgets up 3 years, and Treasury, the debt to GDP rises over that 3-year period, and until the end of that period. So 3 years' time, it is at its highest. Now, Treasury talks about it peaking at that point, but we actually, as Parliament, don't have any numbers beyond 3 years. So when they say peak, we have to trust them, I guess. But I'm interested in the IMF. Do you have a view beyond that 3-year period? Has Treasury shared with you the numbers perhaps for 4 and 5 years, and do they indicate, indeed, as the Treasury said, that the debt will peak in the third year and will start to come down after that? Because right now, according to the numbers that we've seen, you actually have debt increasing right through the medium-term period. And that is something that does raise a concern to me about, or for me, about debt sustainability. Thank you.
Okay. Maybe I could just respond to the
question. Yeah. Maybe as you respond, just to maybe note another question in the form of a comment also. The issue of debt GDP ratio. We are saying our debt is rising in terms of national treasury is going to stabilize at a particular point. But if you compare us with other economies in terms of our debt ratio, are we doing that or are we still within manageable limits, or can we do better in that area? The second set of issues that, because from your presentation, there are two critical areas that I picked up. Is external shocks to our economy and domestic shocks. And I think those are the issues that we need to really focus on, which relays around labor, productivity issues, and so on and so forth. Now, in the last 3 years, 2008 to date, probably 4 years, particularly in Europe, the economic crisis has led to several regime changes. But with those changes,
the situation has not changed. Basu, with a blanket statement. Now, with this to me, it's not an ideological thrust that underpins the challenges in those economies and global economy. There's something more fundamental that needs to be addressed. I guess those who came into power in those countries, they articulated a new vision and a different economic model. But once they're in, the things that they thought they were able to do were unable to be absent. So what is it that you think, in terms of external shocks to the South African economy? We're not insulated. We are part of the global economy. This is what we call external shocks or exogenous effect that impact on South Africa. On a scale of probability, if you were to weigh our domestic challenges or internal shocks and the external shocks that impact on South Africa, even if we were to do everything right in South Africa, what will the external impact be on our economy? And other than looking into diversifying trade and economic activities and looking at the continent, what else do you think needs to be done in that area? Those are the two comments, questions at the same time. Because as we tend to look more inward on the things that we can do much better in South Africa, let's also compare what has happened in other countries. Internally in their own environment, what have they tried to do and has it worked? And for me, I like the point that you are raising, that there are political challenges. But as you try or you attempt to fix certain problems, you must look at the sustainability of the new policies. They must not lead to greater instability. Because if you try to, you need to find a common ground where everybody can buy in. Because different sections of the society are affected differently by the current economic crisis. Of course, unemployment remains very, very high. Unemployment is a key issue, poverty and inequality. Now, the response to this challenge, even internally, will not be the same. So you need to find a balancing act. How do you keep society together for one common objective in dealing with challenges?
Okay, thanks very much. I think those comments are very insightful and goes to the heart of what we have been discussing. I think your point about the balance between the external shocks and the domestic shocks is quite interesting. And I think it's related somewhat to your first comment on the public debt ratio. And whether we should be concerned by its absolute value in terms of how that compares with many other countries in Europe that are now facing much higher public debt ratios, for example. I think from our perspective, I think the key point that we made in the Article 4 consultation, and which I think the National Treasury agrees with, and it comes back to the point that was raised earlier about whether the debt is peaking or is it going to continue rising outside a three-year horizon period. I think the key argument that one can make is that one of the reasons why South Africa was able to respond relatively well to the global economic shock in the very early years of the crisis, 2008, 9, and 10 in particular, was because it started out with very, very low public debt. At that time, I think in the pre-crisis years, the public debt ratio was under 30% of GDP. Now, what that means is that you had a lot of fiscal room to respond to the external shock, and you made use of that room in the early phases of the crisis by appropriately allowing a larger fiscal deficit. You allowed the debt ratio to rise because you had the room for that to happen, and were able to mitigate somewhat the impact of the external shock. So
the question that you raise, which is, you know, what if you do everything right, but you sit up the external shock? It is true that you cannot do anything about external shock except make your economy more resilient. In terms of, as we mentioned, if you're affected mainly through trade channels, you can, of course, try to diversify over time and so on. But you can also try to mitigate that impact by counter-cyclical fiscal and monetary policies. And to the extent that you have the fiscal room to do so, you will be more likely to be successful. If you're already at your debt limit, then you will be less likely to be able to do that. And even though you may consider your current debt levels not to be very high, for investors who will finance this debt, it's very important for them to have confidence that you have credible medium to long-term fiscal policies that will restore or enhance your long-term solvency as government. So the higher your debt ratio is, the more you get into that very sort of gray area where you can actually have investor confidence becoming weak, that you will be able to recover afterwards and bring your debt levels down. So the strategy that the government adopted in the budget and which we agreed was that they used up a lot of that fiscal room very early in the crisis, and we think it was appropriate. But now is the time to consolidate over the medium term and to bring that debt level down. Now, it is true that the horizon that is presented is only 3 years, and you don't see the debt ratio coming down. But in the sort of long-term fiscal report that the National Treasury is planning to produce, the expectation is that it will come down over the long term. And in our Article 4 consultation report, you will see that we have it, so our projection is that it will come down outside of that three-year horizon period. So we have discussed this with the government. I think their overall strategy is to achieve that objective. We think that that is the way to restore confidence in your long-term public finances. And it is in that context that we believe that if there is any further deterioration in the global environment, you may have to rely more on monetary policies because you don't have a lot more fiscal room. So if you want to make sure that you will have that fiscal room in the future, then you have to rebuild those buffers, rebuild that cushion that you had, because that's what served you very well in 2008, 2009, 2010, because you started out with that kind of a fiscal buffer. And so the challenge is to get back to somewhere near that so that when the next crisis hits, you have more flexibility in terms of how you respond. So that's sort of how I would respond to both questions in terms of the dynamics between the external shock and what you can do domestically, and also what role your public debt plays in your overall ability to respond and mitigate the shocks that you face. Now, your first question about the Brazilian, I don't know if Roberto wants to add anything on that, but let me just say that the example that Roberto gives is very Brazilian specific, and as you mentioned, the fiscal system may be a little bit different there. You know, we have not yet discussed with the government anything about special funds for capital projects. I think the point that we're making is that, and I think the point he's making is that in a Brazilian case, this served them well in terms of making sure that capital projects were well-funded and implemented as planned. And what we have to do is to find a way in the South African fiscal system to do the same. Now, whether you do that through a special fund or you do it through the budget, the critical thing is to make sure that you address the underlying bottlenecks that are involved in those projects in terms of their formulation, their planning, and execution. And that's what we need to be focused on. And I think that's the Brazilian example that's the point I think Roberto is trying to emphasize.
Kind of the infrastructure financing. As you know, before, like 20 years ago, Canada's unemployment rate is also very high, about like 80% of people unemployed. And what we did is, although I think the infrastructure investment plays a big role, and I think the key question you are interested in, how to finance those infrastructure. In China, we did is we issue infrastructure bonds. So we raise money through infrastructure bonds to finance those infrastructure investment, not through budget. And the second point that you raise is, what is the potential impact from the leadership change in China. And personally, I think the impact on the world economy as well as on China's economy would be positive. Why is that? Because China has this kind of leadership change phenomenon. The incumbent leadership, but in the election year, they would like to make the growth slow down the growth, so that the new leadership has like a low base for them to build a credibility. That's one point. The second is also another issue. China's economic reform has faced some new bottlenecks and challenges. For example, we like lose a little bit on the labor market mobility, but still has many restrictions on the labor market mobility. For example, some like people from like some province move to Beijing or Shanghai, they got a job, but they cannot, even now they cannot send their kids to the schools or in Shanghai or Beijing. They have to send their kids back to their old village to get education. But I heard the new leadership, they want to like reform this areas, restrictions. I think these reforms will unleash these restrictions and the Chinese economy will find a new growth area in the next few years.
Honorable Ross, I'm becoming very flexible because my understanding is that in the next two items, we are going to make up for the time that you are giving to IMF discussion. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair, for being so flexible and in a good mood today. I appreciate it. Thank you. It is just very interesting, the alternative funding model that later speakers also mentioned and also you said. Thank you very much in terms of the infrastructure bonds. And we know that ESCOM has gone a long way in terms of the ESCOM bonds that they issued. And in terms of alternative funding, I think we've made a lot of progress. However, I have to note that we, in terms of the National Development Plan, which I proposed to Professor Eber in our discussions with the National Development Plan, that we should have a specific section in terms of funding and pricing, and that we never got to that. Perhaps that's an area where we should basically refine, you know, in terms of how we can lessen the burden on the consumers in terms of access and tariffs. And I believe that you correctly said that that's an area that we should monitor the risk, and indeed that's becoming a huge risk in terms of the smaller business can't afford electricity and they can't expand and they can't create jobs. And that's the platform where you would like to see significant jobs to be created at that level. But that administered crisis is indeed becoming a huge risk. And perhaps, Chair, with you being so lenient there, that we should make an admission to Minister Manuel in terms of the National Development Plan that we should insert that section on funding and pricing, and especially also the gentleman from Brasilia indicating that the alternative budget for perhaps capital funding that my colleague has asked about, and those issues need to be put together coherently to see how can we fund our infrastructure challenges, because that is indeed a huge challenge. Thank you very much, sir, for your patience. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members, but also let me just take this opportunity to thank the IMF delegation for a very, very good input. We might have left more questions on our side that provide answers, but I am sure in your next round of discussions with National Treasury, with the Reserve Bank, and the private sector banks, and the private sector in general, you find more answers to some of the issues that we've not been able to respond to adequately so. But I am certain that you also detect that there's a slight gap between what the executive does and what Parliament knows as you move on. Some of the issues like the Brazilian model in terms of I think what you call alternative budgeting is what you call top slicing. You know, making sure that resources and funding reserved for a particular program, particular infrastructure spend, is not completely devoid of what we are doing in South Africa already in terms of infrastructure spending. That is why earlier on, the earlier input would have said we have realized that 60% of infrastructure spend has not been able to be dispersed because of capacity issues. So it might be that we don't necessarily have a problem of resources, a problem of capacity and planning in terms of implementation. And probably those are the issues that we may need to look into going forward. So I thought I should have made that point. And agreeing with your colleague from on the Chinese experience, in terms of what regime change means, change in leadership historically has always been accompanied by investor confidence, because every leader comes with a new plan. And I think something that is very perfect in an emerging democracy like ourselves, so that you don't have challenges in terms of when there's about to be changes in leadership, there's investor, not confidence, but a little bit of uncertainty in that particular regard. And I think there are a number of countries that have actually created that art. Even in the continent, if you look into Mozambique, the rise in terms of investor confidence in Botswana is precisely because of how they manage the transition in terms of leadership. And I think that is a perfect example in that regard. So I thought I should make these few comments. The rest, we continue to engage amongst ourselves. And what you have heard is the committee views, not the individual party political positions. I thought I should make that point very, very clear. Thank you.
Thank you.
And our members can take a 5-minute break when you come back.